South Dakota has been unable to tackle the root causes of infant mortality. We get to know the people who are showing up for one another during crisis. From SDPB, today is Monday, October 27th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, South Dakota has an infant mortality rate of more than 7 deaths per 1,000 live births. Now, that data has remained mostly stable for the past 11 years, which is not considered a success. Much work needs to be done to save lives. Today, we look at the way we measure infant mortality, the way we talk about pregnancy and infant loss, and the way we care for people after a baby dies. It is not an easy conversation, but our guests remind us talking about this openly is one way to acknowledge its role in our lives and search for solutions. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Today we are exploring an important but difficult topic. We're talking about how we respond to one of life's hardest realities, infant mortality. Now, we are carefully crafting this hour knowing that many of our listeners have either lived this experience or love someone who has. And I know that this might be an episode you're not ready to listen to right now, and if so, do not feel bad about turning that dial. But please know that these conversations are here for you when you are ready to listen. And all of our guests this hour agreed that infant loss in its various forms is really important to talk about openly. So we hope the hour will be of service to the public. This episode originally sprang from a press release. Sanford Health is planning on opening a birthing and bereavement suite at its USD Medical Center in Sioux Falls. It hopes to offer a peaceful, comforting, and healing place for grieving parents and their loved ones. And that got us thinking about how we talk about infant loss. Who are the South Dakotans who show up for us in our times of need? And how do we overall approach reproductive health in this state? We're going to start here with a conversation with Melissa Magstead, South Dakota's Secretary of the Department of Health.
In the Department of Health, we gather a lot of data about the people of South Dakota, not necessarily about my personal data, but as a population, we gather an enormous amount of data to help us understand trends, health trends about our state, and help us understand what to do about them. Because, you know, gathering data without having sort of a vision about what you want to do with that and how you want to make the lives of South Dakotans better would just be gathering data for no purpose. But we have in our department the Office of Vital Statistics. So, you know, every time a birth or a death, marriage or divorce happens in the state of South Dakota, we have the privilege of recording the events that happened around that birth and that death and the details about it. And so our vital records of all the citizens that have been born and that we have lost through the state have been recorded in the Office of Vital Records. And so we consider it a very privileged place to be able to write the beginning and the end of people's lives. But that data is also very important to us as we use it to understand what were the contributors around that birth, what were the contributors around that death as well. And it helps us to understand trends and areas of potential impact to make a positive impact for the future. But we also try to understand the deeper parts, especially when it comes to either maternal mortality or infant mortality. And we have two committees that are review that more in depth. One is the Maternal Mortality Review Committee, and one is the Child Death Review Committee. And just like it sounds, these are very difficult committees to be on. We have healthcare providers from across the state that come and look at those deaths person one by one and try to understand what contributed to the loss of that life. A very difficult committee to be on, so the people that serve on that are very passionate and compassionate for the loss of life as they're reading through those records to try and help understand it. So that's where our data and our bigger picture comes from, in understanding what contributed to the loss of that life, of that little one.
Yeah.
And so that's where our data and our picture comes from, is those two points.
So when I'm looking at the South Dakota infant mortality analysis for 2024, and I'm looking at those numbers, is that measuring infants who took a breath in life? Is that measuring stillbirth infants? What am I looking at?
Yeah, great question. How our infant deaths would be from a live birth all the way to 1 year. Okay. That is considered the time that we would measure infant death. Live birth up to 1 year. Actually, it's just one day before their first birthday. Neonatal birth would be from live birth to the first 28 days of life. But infant mortality is live birth to that 1 year mark is where our counts would come from.
And then what about perinatal or a miscarriage? How are we measuring the vast nuances of that?
In miscarriage, it depends on when those in the pregnancies, those would occur. If early along in the pregnancy, we would not have any measurement of miscarriage. So early on in the pregnancy, but once you get to a certain point, and I believe it's 20 weeks on up, then we would be able to have that data of and count when we would consider that fetal loss.
Okay.
And so early on in the pregnancy, say a mother has a miscarriage at 10 weeks, we would not have that recording and that would not be reportable to the State Department of Health. So that number would be a number that'd be very, very difficult to estimate for South Dakota because we just don't collect that data.
Okay, so all these, and I'm looking at the infant mortality now, I find it very impactful what you said, that there are healthcare providers and people who are looking at each individual
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to brush past that at all. And we're going to talk about some
yep.
of those individual stories. But from a statistical point, when you look at the numbers overall, what kind of trends are you seeing in South Dakota?
South Dakota, unfortunately, has consistently had a higher infant mortality rate than the nation for the last 10 years plus. And so it's been a very much a challenge for us. But I think even the more telling thing is that for our population, that there are certain populations in our state that suffer greater loss than others.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically talking about our infant loss when it comes to Native American babies. Our infant loss is even a little higher when it comes to our loss of our African American babies compared to our white South Dakotans. So we've got some disparities, not only a little higher level in general, but there are certain populations that unfortunately suffer greater loss than other populations in South Dakota.
Help me understand some of the response to these numbers. We want them to continually decrease. We want to continually be getting better. We're not getting better. And you're trying to find out why, but you're also trying to respond. Help me understand some of those responses.
So we in the department said that we were going to start targeting this thing called the first 1,000 days.
Okay.
So the first 1,000 days is something that happens in everyone's life before you even knew it happened. And so it's from the day of conception all the way through the pregnancy to the first 2 years of life. That's your first 1,000 days. And in your first 1,000 days, everyone sort of instinctively knows, but all experts would absolutely agree, that what happens in those first 1,000 days sets up a trajectory for the rest of your life, whether that's brain health, heart health, lung health, but also emotional and mental and emotional connections and emotional health all happen in that first 1,000 days of life. And so what we're dialing into and what we have been in the Department of Health, but including with the Maternal Health Task Force, is that dialing into the things that make everyone's first 1,000 days their best 1,000 days. Because if we get that right for whatever person it is, we've really truly set them up on a good trajectory for whatever the rest of their life is, physically, emotionally, mentally. The best first 1,000 days is that foundational piece. So, you know, sort of just in our talking, so if I mention that terminology, you know what I'm mm-hmm. saying when I talk about those first 1,000 days. So in the Department of Health, we have resources that we are using to target towards that. Our pregnancy care program, we have a program called Bright Start, which is a home visiting program, which comes alongside first-time mothers all the way through pregnancy, weekly visits all the way up into the 2 years after that baby is born, and comes alongside that mom hand by hand, helping her, number one, making sure she's eating healthy, make sure she's getting to her prenatal exams, but also helping her understand potential red flags and get her connected to her provider. And then that Bright Start nurse stays with that mother for the next 2 years, helping to make sure baby's hitting those developmental milestones, make sure good nutrition is happening, make sure mom is safe. And, you know, I even had anecdotal reports that some of these mothers, through that support of that Bright Start nurse, have gone on to secure even further economic foundational support with going back to school or obtaining gainful employment for the long term. So that Bright Start nurse and that team really is about helping to support that first 1,000 days to make sure that whatever it is to help that first-time mom and first-time family, because dads are included in that too, is the best that it can be. We also have our pregnancy care program. What's the difference between that one and our Bright Start? Our Bright Start is first-time families only. Our pregnancy care, you know, you could be your fourth time in pregnancy, and we're still going to come along, support you, help make sure that you're getting to your appointments, make sure that any red flags are caught early, make sure that you're getting your healthy nutrition, make sure if you're a mom struggling even with tobacco use that we help you with the resources to make sure you're supported and discontinuing that for pregnancy, and hopefully continuing that discontinuation all the way after pregnancy as well. So our pregnancy care program is like that. But then we have things that will help support the little ones after birth. And I think one of the most critical ones is our safe sleep programs. In our data, one of the highest impacts of losing an infant after that healthy baby is born within that first year is losing our children to the sudden unexpected infant death syndrome. So we used to call that SIDS. Mm-hmm. We call it sudden unexpected infant death syndrome now, but it's really when a healthy baby was born and unexpectedly we lose them in that first year of time. And the vast majority are related to unsafe sleep practices. So making sure that families have cribs, making sure that families have pack and plays, so that every time they lay down baby to sleep, they lay down baby in a healthy, safe way, in their own bed, on a hard surface, without extra fluffy toys and extra blankets, and on their back every time. And that is one of our key pushes to make sure. And it sounds so simple, right? It sounds so simple. But when you consider 87% of sleep-related loss is related to unsafe sleep practices, that the message of how simple it is to lay down your baby safely and healthy, that we need to keep pushing that out and making sure that every family knows that every time.
Yeah. That is Melissa Magstadt, South Dakota Secretary of the Department of Health. Up next, we'll dive deep into a conversation about language. How do we talk to each other about loss when we are at a loss for words? Or when does the right kind of language just not exist? The authors of the book, I'm Sorry for My Loss, are up next, and you're in the moment, here on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Today's episode is an in-depth look at infant mortality. How do we respond to one of the most difficult life experiences we know? Well, we're going to continue this conversation with the authors of the book, I'm Sorry for My Loss, An Urgent Examination of Reproductive Care in America. Here's our conversation with Rebecca Little and Colleen Long.
One of the things that we found during our research, you know, I thought that there aren't answers to questions related to reproductive health because it was this sort of ethereal, you know, confusing thing. You know, it's a liminal state and pregnancy is... it's just so strange, so we can't possibly know the answers. And while I was looking into while I was researching for the book, I discovered that actually we're just not asking the questions. Mm-hmm. There are answers available if we seek out the questions. Now there's more research being done. Well, I should say there was more research being done on pregnancy loss in the past, I don't know, let's say 10 years than there ever has been, but compared to, you know, the whole of medical research, it's not very much.
Rebecca, what did you want to add? Yeah.
So yeah, the language ended up coming up in almost every interview we did, even before we asked about it, because so much of our language is either, it sounds kind of judgmental, like incompetent cervix or lazy ovary. Like it almost sounds like your bodily systems that you have no control over are somehow like disobedient in a way that we don't, you know, if someone has kidney cancer, we don't say like their kidney broke. And certainly if someone has male factor infertility, you know, we don't say their penis broke. But all the language around the female body was like, people would go into these appointments where they already were feeling frustrated in some way and come out and be like, am I in trouble? Did I do something wrong? And the language, as far as we talk about like the pregnancy, we, first of all, the fact talking about it all, like you said, is really since the 70s. Like the our bodies ourselves, where we're even allowed to use any of these words, actual just medical words about our body parts. But there's a lot of euphemisms, right? I mean, if you go, it's pretty much what the vagina monologues is, right? It's like everyone's different euphemism for, or, you know, their various parts. And it's confusing because the language also is a lot of times couched. So you lost the pregnancy, or there's no heartbeat, or it's not direct. And so then that indirection confuses people. Like if you are in a, for example, in an ultrasound and you go in and they say there's no heartbeat, a lot of times you're not processing that right away, you know? So you go, like that happened to me, and I just said, oh, and I just shifted my belly because I thought they meant they just had to look a different place.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until somebody said the baby died that you know what death means, you know what die means. And then it starts to sink in. And there was a lot of people who said that, where they, that language just didn't even like penetrate until it was used, the direct term was used. And we don't have great terms for, technically, medically, pregnancy is an embryo until 8 weeks, then a fetus really until birth, and then it's baby. But that's not how we talk about our pregnancies. You know, we don't, like we said, look, we don't throw fetus showers. We don't, you know, say like, I can't wait till my fetus turns into a baby. And there's not these, even the embryo to fetus isn't like checking off, you know, the cardiovascular system or something. It's just sort of a thing that we've denoted. And the medical terms are clinical. They're not emotional. Baby's emotional and pregnancy is emotional. And so then when you lose that, part of where it gets hard to talk about is people don't know what to say for a lot of reasons. I mean, America's very bad at grief in general, but it's also, we don't really know how to talk about a pregnancy because we literally don't know what words to use, especially when there's grief involved in it.
Yeah.
Even with miscarriage, the medical term for miscarriage is a spontaneous abortion. And people who miscarry will see that on their charts and be very upset because that's not how they viewed their pregnancy. But medically, you know, that's what it is. So it's really confusing. And especially, as Rebecca said, when you add in this layer of grief and also the sort of trauma of the moment, which makes it even harder for you to understand what's happening. It's a real mess. It can be a real mess.
Are there other things that are that surprised you, that were like, oh no, that is something that a well-intentioned person might say, even after thinking it through, they didn't just blurt this out, but it turned out to be really unhelpful or even damaging?
You know, I think this applies to a lot of grief, but anytime you ever ask the person who is grieving, let me know if you need anything, that's not helpful. You've given them work to do. Whereas you can just show up with groceries or, you know, things from Costco or whatever, and you don't have to say, you don't really need their grocery list. You can sort of guess, or you can give them Uber Eats gift cards. There are things where you can be helpful without saying, well, you know, give me a list of what you need, because now you've given them extra work to do and you've made yourself feel better without really helping.
Right. Colleen, what would you add?
Silence. There's a lot of people don't want to impose. They don't want to ruin somebody's day. That's what people said to me. Well, I didn't want to ruin your day by reminding you of your stillbirth. And you know, you're like, what do you think? I stopped thinking about it? Like, no. So I think silence can be pretty harmful. Even just like a very small acknowledgement, just, you know, I'm so sorry for you and your family. That does wonders for people.
What they did at some of these hospitals too, is that people are trained to not ask them what pregnancy this is, what pregnancy number, like how many times you've been pregnant, like, which is a medical question, but you can look in the chart to not ask that, or to not say like, do you have any other kids at home? Just, they don't ask anything about that. If you bring it up, fine. but they don't ask any of those things, which I don't know that I necessarily would have thought of.
Other things that people do in hospitals that we were impressed by, a bereavement room is we would say that's impressive. Mm-hmm. Another thing is in some hospitals, they offer photography, like free photography for the parents and the baby, which in previously it was just sort of like there were either no images or they were kind of like hospital related images, but these are professional photographers sort of donating their time. Mm. One thing we heard a lot about in the moment is that in the moment you think one thing and then later you think something else. So like, for example, for me, I don't have anything. I don't have any pictures. And anything that I had got lost in a move, which was terrible. It was just my sort of hospital bracelet and the old sonogram image, you know, so people might not necessarily think they want these things, but it's better to maybe do it in the moment. And, you know, you could just like Rebecca does, she just puts it in a box and leaves it there and doesn't ever look at it.
Right. Yeah. I'm hearing that friendship matters a great deal. Mm-hmm. Having someone that you can talk to, someone who shares your sense of your sensibilities. And Rebecca and Colleen's case, the sense of humor, I find delightful. That might not work for everybody, but the friend that matches your kind of, you know, conversational tone is mm-hmm. great to be asking the questions. What about, you know, funerals and the human grieving processes that we are used to? If someone reaches an old age, for example, or if someone dies of cancer, that are they the same, transferable, or starkly different in pregnancy or infant loss?
So what this is known as, it's called an out of order loss. So you mm-hmm. sort of expect your grandparent to go before you. Maybe you expect your parent to go before you. But when you have these out of order losses, like babies are supposed to be born, they're not supposed to die. That cultural script sort of falls off the rails. Even among religious people, you know, there's not sort of the same prescribed things that you do when a baby dies. Like if you're Catholic, if a baby never took a breath, it can't be baptized, but it can have a blessing. For Jewish people, you don't have a service until they have survived for 30 days. And part of this is because these are based on ancient religions and babies were dying all the time in ancient times. And so you would be constantly mourning if you were doing this, you know, in the first century. So they come from these old things that are sort of outdated. And people were like, well, everyone just sort of said like, well, you know, I'm sorry, but you can have another. It was very much like you would not go to someone's dad's funeral and say, well, you still got a mom. You know, there's this sense that you can just sort of swap out the experience. Whereas, you know, Midwestern, you drop off a casserole, mm-hmm. you know, at the very least, you should get a ha-ha dish, right? And that wasn't really happening for these people who had miscarriages. It was very much like, oh, you know, that's too bad, but, you know, you can have another, you can move on. It was like sort of had to bootstrap your way to get to the next pregnancy and not acknowledge the loss of this one. And I do think it's getting better. I think that people probably between 30 and 40 right now are doing a much better job of saying that I don't accept that. They're saying to their rabbis or to their priests or to their ministers or to their friends, this isn't going to work for me. I need to have a service or I need to have an acknowledgement. About 60% of the people we interviewed got tattoos as something they felt that their body had been through an experience. And so they put on their body something permanent to commemorate the baby, or they had their own service at the park, or they just weren't accepting that there was no ritual and they were making their own, which mm-hmm. I really found impressive. They were not, there was a lot of generational talk, like our moms, our grandmothers had losses and there was no discussion of it. Or people we interviewed had no idea that their parents or grandmothers had had losses until they did. And they said, well, you know, I lost a baby. Like, what are you talking about? When? Yeah. Oh, you know, he was SIDS. We just got over it. And it was fascinating that they were like, nobody knew. And now they're sort of reexamining that relationship generationally with these people and these younger people doing a more overt job of saying, no, my grief matters here.
funerals can be costly. Can you remind me, Rebecca, there's like in some cases, there's like, I don't remember. There was a discount or something.
Yes.
Maybe I'm making that up.
Yes. No, you're not.
Okay.
There are some funeral homes and some cemeteries will either if the baby was cremated, will do they give you for free, like a little spot in a mausoleum. And some funeral homes will do some of those things for free, but it's not a guarantee. And if you want to have a burial, like some people will bury the baby with a parent or a grandparent, that's can be $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 if you want a marker. Like, so some people who may want to do something just flat out can't afford it.
Yeah. It cannot be an expense that you're ever prepared for.
No.
Because of the out of order loss alone, plus all the other expenses of pregnancy in this country. You that's not on the list. That's not on your line item.
Also, I think because, you know, over the past 40 years or so, we really believe that because there was so much control over pregnancy, we believe that the pregnancy will work out fine because we're choosing the pregnancy. So that's the other kind of surprise for people, because they think if they're gonna, you know, that they're choosing to get pregnant, so it's going to work out great. But the statistics tell us otherwise. You know, 1 in 5 women will have a miscarriage. Stillbirths are a smaller subset, but they're far less rare than people would think. But we just don't talk about it very much. So it ends up like swept under the rug, you know.
I can't tell you how many times, you already know, but I'm just thinking back to how many times when I was pregnant, I heard your body knows what to do. This is a natural thing. Mm-hmm. And if that is interrupted and all of a sudden something bad happens and unexpected happens, how easy it would be to tell yourself that my body didn't know what to do, or somehow this is my fault, or somehow what happened, because I've been reading in these books how beautiful, natural, and intuitive pregnancy and childbirth is for women, and mothering. The pink and blue, you know, fluffy blanket nature of how we market motherhood.
So many people, so many women told us they felt it was their fault. I mean, I felt like it was my fault. The truth is, I still kind of think it's my fault, even though I know that it's not, you know?
I get very mad at her about it.
I'm sorry.
It's not your fault. Yeah.
I know. We spoke to one doctor and we put her in the book, and she was great. She was like, you know, it's like in Good Will Hunting when Robin Williams keeps saying to, you know, it's sorry, Matt Damon. Yeah, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. You know, she's like, I just want to release everybody from this. It's not your fault. But a lot of people sure think it is.
And it's like you said, so what's interesting is in this new era we're in, where mothers and babies are both probably going to survive into adulthood. Like, you're going to survive the birth and your kid is probably going to survive into adulthood, has really only been the case since after World War II, which isn't that long ago. And before that, these out-of-order losses were really part of the fabric of your life, and that people knew what to do because everyone you knew had had this experience. It was just part of life. And so when it changed after World War II, mostly because of blood transfusions, and so if the woman was hemorrhaging, they could save it. Better preemie care, you know, we had incubators, so you were able to save babies if they were born prematurely. And then vaccines and antibiotics. So all those things meant those baby boomers were going to make it. And it's kind of interesting how quickly we leaned into that culturally and forgot the memory from before, which you get why. Like, it's a happy development. You see why they were like, okay, you know, onward and upward. It was an optimistic time in America. But then we lost the script for what to do with that. And then part of that was this, I would say, maybe in the 70s and beyond, like you said, this sort of everything's natural, your body knows what to do. And there was this also the sense that like science was limitless, right? That we were going to be able to figure this out. And added on top of that was the politics of the 1980s, where the personal became very political. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of left people who had experienced a miscarriage thinking, well, I did something wrong. I mean, I remember after my stillbirth, I didn't even use nail polish, which was of course not going to cause it. But I mean, I went back through and was like, well, what could it have been? And it was a genetic, the die was cast the second sperm met egg. I didn't know that, but that in most cases, a miscarriage that is what it is. It's genetic mismatch. There's nothing you could have done. And to be told, like, well, you know, your body knows what to do. Well, you know what? My body didn't know what to do because I had a missed miscarriage with my first one. My body did not get the message that pregnancy was over and that I had to have the, essentially the abortion pill, same thing. It induces the miscarriage. It didn't work. I had a uterine infection, ended up having a DNC. So no, your body doesn't always know what to do.
But any proactive effort to acknowledge this kind of loss and to recognize it and to give people like a minute to feel sad and bad about it is really like it's almost revolutionary. You know, I it's a small thing, but what we found in our research is just how rare the recognition of it is. So to be in a place where there is recognition, like even systemic recognition, that's even more kind of surprising to me. So it's really a step in a positive direction.
Yeah. What do we owe our grandmothers? Those women who had this kind of loss and didn't talk, maybe we learned of it after they were gone. Maybe we learned of it, but they didn't get to process it. What do we owe them today?
You know, and that was, it was interesting. A lot of people we talked to felt that we have to stop this. We have to stop this cycle for those grandmothers or for those mothers. You know, my mom had a loss. It was probably 17, 18 weeks. And it was traumatic. She lost a lot of blood. And she said, you know, was a boy or girl? And they said, you don't need to know that. And she saw them put the fetus in the medical waste and in the room with her. And she said, you know, I was sad, but I went home. She got pregnant with my brother pretty quickly and was just moved on. And it was interesting when I had my losses, she really started to reexamine that experience and went, wait, that was terrible. Yeah. I said, yeah, that was terrible, Mom. And so I think that was an experience a lot of people had too, was that their parents also went, yeah, you, even if they were a little bit uncomfortable in the beginning with the way their kids were processing it and were needing to sort of have an emotional experience or a grief experience. And they went, you know what? Actually, I think you were right. And so I do think this is helpful, not just for us, but to break that silence cycle, because so much of miscarriage is shame and silence and grief.
Yeah. Final thoughts, Colleen?
Gosh, I don't know. I think Rebecca really summed it up. I think, talking about it is just, it's hard. I mean, it's funny too, because neither one of us are like big emotional sharers, being Midwestern as we are.
Right, yeah.
But we do really think in this case, you know, again, I will just say, you don't have to, there is no need for a huge flourish, just a simple, I'm so sorry for you. How are you doing? Also, another thing, like 3 months from the moment that the thing happened, put it in your phone, you know, set a reminder for 3 months from now to check on that person and just say, how are you doing? Are you feeling okay? I'm so sorry for you. And that, it will go miles for people, truly.
Authors Rebecca Little and Colleen Long, their book is called I'm Sorry for My Loss. Up next, we invite funeral home professionals to the program. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Next, we bring you a conversation with Kristen Peterson and Tom Shelsky. They are both funeral directors at Heritage Funeral Home in Sioux Falls. We're talking today about how a community can support parents surrounding the death of an infant. Peterson and Shelsky joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Kristen, if we could start with you and say, this is something you see a fair amount of in your work.
We do. We do. Unfortunately, we care. You know, we're grateful to care for these families who have had loss, but it happens more than I think people realize.
Yeah. And so how do you get involved in a family's life? Because they're not planning. This is almost, well, sometimes it's planned. I mean, that you would know mm-hmm. and you would start making arrangements. But more often than not, is it a, well, now we have to figure out who to call situation? Right.
I think oftentimes it's through those great relationships with the hospital teams when a loss occurs, whether it's an anticipatory loss or an unexpected loss. Oftentimes it's the hospital teams who are great here to connect families with a funeral home who can offer support. Other times, that it's families we've served in the past. So just a couple weeks ago, we had someone who had an infant loss, and they called and said, hey, when my grandpa died, you took care of grandpa, and now we just had an infant loss ourselves. Can you walk us through what to do? So oftentimes it's based on prior relationships, but there's a lot of times we meet families for the first time when a loss like this occurs.
Tom, what is one of the first things that you will say to a family?
It's... It all kind of depends. You kind of read the room when they come in to figure out what they're kind of looking for. Obviously, you offer condolences and things like that. There's a lot of things you can say that it doesn't mean anything just because of the loss that they're going through. So the things you say, they might not be listening to them because their mind is 1,000 miles away on other things. So most of the time, you just try to figure out kind of what they want to do. What are we looking at? Are we looking at services? Are we looking at doing a cremation or what we would consider a more traditional service with casket and things like that.
Yeah. What are some of the difficult decisions, Kristen, that people have to make?
I think Tom's right. It's when that little one comes into our care of the decision of how we best care for that infant that's been lost and the decision that has to be made, sometimes in a relatively short period of time, as to how we best care for that.
Talk to me about dignity in death. Because if you do some searching and Googling, the first thing you find is some horrible headline of some bad thing that happened in some community far away. Mm-hmm. And I just want to lead with, how do you think about that in your work?
Mm-hmm. I think there is so much care and respect for every funeral home here and how we care for everyone from our littlest to our oldest. And we really realize these are sacred, intimate places that we go into. So often when there's an infant loss, Tom or I or one of the other directors, we're going to the labor and delivery floor to build that respect and rapport, to make sure they know that we're on the same page and that we're transferring care of baby and we have them be as involved as they want to be. Yeah. We walk into really raw, real situations and we move at their pace. So wherever they are on the journey, that's where we're at.
Yeah. How did you learn how to do that well?
We're still learning.
Still learning, yeah.
It's ever-changing, just depending on the who, the what, the where. Every family's a little bit different. Every family experiences things just a little bit differently. So you just try to read the room, or even in the moment, a light bulb goes off in your head of, okay, we're not going to go down this direction. We're going to go a different direction and things like that. It's I feel like if you box yourself in with saying this is how I meet every infant loss, you're not gonna serve the family properly.
Yeah. There's not a checklist.
There is not a checklist. No. It's all in the moment and it can change so fast and families change their minds too on decisions. And so for us to be flexible and kind of go at their pace, that's exactly where we're at.
What kinds of options and choices do they have? You mentioned a cremation or a burial with a casket. Are there other things that are unique to infant loss that I want to make it seem like just like, an industry has responded. But, in some ways, what have you seen some families decide to do that might have meaning and purpose for other families?
This one I've got to think on. Because a lot of it is still just, I shouldn't say just, but a cremation or the traditional casket service. A lot of the other things involve just different things like memorials and things such as at the service and things like that.
Sure.
As far as options outside of cremation and in the traditional service, it's more of the things they can do such as fingerprint molds and things along those lines that kind of keep that infant's memory still alive after the decisions have been made or the services are over.
And I guess specifically what I'm wondering, Kristen, is the things that you have seen families do that might have meaning a year from now. 10 years from now, 20 years from now?
I think it's some of those legacy pieces that Tom talked about, those keepsakes, but I also have seen incredible families work through loss and paying it forward, and how we can how I got into funeral service, I was also a chaplain at Sanford for a number of years, and it was through an infant loss, a family who had triplets, and the triplets died on three separate days. And I happened to be the chaplain on call when the twins, they lost one infant at about 17 weeks, and they delivered twins, one baby girl, one baby boy, at about 25 weeks. Cold December day, baby boy survived for about 7 hours. And when the family was ready to transfer care to the funeral home, it was Heritage and one of the other directors that came to the labor and delivery floor. And I ran into him and I said, oh gosh, I'm glad it's you, because I know you're going to be good to this family. And he said, oh, I'm glad it's you that's with them. And so we worked together with this family. Well, 31 days later, their third infant died at about, and so then we kind of got back together and did a traditional burial for their third baby. So three losses on three separate days. This family has every single year done a fundraiser, a golf tournament in their hometown in Minnesota to raise funds, because they were so impacted by the generosity that we extended to them, along with the hospital system that they were working with and the hospice team, and they have since paid it forward. And so every year they will then take some of the funds from that golf tournament to shower love on families who've had similar loss. There are two beautiful granite benches outside our funeral home that were donated by this family. They didn't want their names on them. They didn't want to be recognized in any ways, but they said, we want a place that people, if they need a little bit of fresh air, a place to sit, we want to give something back to your funeral home.
Yeah.
And so that's some of those neat things that I've seen people work through their grief to be generous.
Yeah. How has doing this work changed your life?
People always say, you know, be nice to everyone. You don't know what they're going through or what their challenges are facing. But we see that come through the funeral home every day. And it's even some of it, you kind of put your life on hold to, you know, to do your job. So are there things in my life that start lacking a little bit because of my career choice? Yes, there are. Are they so detrimental to me that I would leave the field? Absolutely not. I mean, I go home and I feel, you know, it's weird to say, I feel great about the things I've done, or the, you know, if we had a funeral that day and everything goes as planned, I feel absolutely wonderful that celebration for that individual worked. You know, it makes me a better person to be able to help people in those times of need.
Yeah. How about you, Kristen? How has it changed you?
I think I live more of a life of gratitude and appreciation of being grateful for each day and each moment, being grateful to be in some of those sacred spaces in people's lives and not taking things for granted. We unfortunately run into so many situations of people who, if you ask them last week, where did you anticipate to be today, it would not be a funeral home.
Right, yeah.
That's raw and that is real. And so it often centers and grounds me of where my priorities are.
Yeah.
And like Tom said, you know, you're next to someone in line at Hy-Vee, you may have no idea what they're going through, but a little bit of compassion and kindness and grace goes a long way.
Yeah. Is there something else that you wanted to add? Maybe misunderstandings or things that you want families to know?
I don't know if I should even share this, but you think about, I've never dealt with an infant loss personally, and sometimes that makes it difficult to go in these moments with these people. You know, I can't tell them how I would have felt or how I would have done things. And that even extends on to adults, to teenagers, to middle-aged people. It's just, I can try to help you the best I can, but, you know, sometimes people look for that, like, oh, have you been through this? Well, I haven't, but I feel like our team and myself, we will make sure that you are heard and it's felt and it's honest and we're not trying to pull the wool over people's eyes or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's hard, but my suggestion would be use your voice, because sometimes we can't read people's mind. And so don't be afraid if you do have a loss to ask for what you want, because, like Tom said, we go over the moon and back, as the other funeral homes do, to accommodate what the wishes are of the family. It could be as simple. I've had a family who had an infant loss. It was a full-term loss, and they said, we just really want to bring our baby and put her in her crib that was prepared for her. And so may we take her to our home and put her in the crib and spend time with her and hold her in the rocking chair that was prepared for her, and then we would return her to the funeral home before we transitioned to burial. It took a lot of courage for them to ask the nurse practitioner at the hospital, for the practitioner to call us, so that we could work out a safe plan to accommodate their needs. And so not to to have the courage to say, would it be possible to do this? Or my heart's really feeling pulled to do that. Or is it okay that I put these keepsakes in my little one's casket?
Yes. Use your voice. Ask the question.
Yes.
Yeah. Because what we don't want is regret of days, months, years of, I wish I could have got this, or I wish I would have asked this, or I wonder if they could have done that.
Or you get that phone call from a family that says, hey, could we have done this? And it's like, yes, we could have, but like Kristen said, if we don't know, I can't assume. I don't want to do something that no one has asked me to do.
Right. Yeah.
Because sometimes, again, that's a touchy moment of us making a decision for someone. It can open a lot of other doors.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's not a menu that we offer. You know, of like what do you want to do? Pick from these options. Yeah. There are so many customizable options from. Would it be okay if the siblings came in because the little ones weren't allowed, say, in the NICU? Could the siblings of this infant loss come in and see their sibling prior to cremation? Absolutely. But to be able to talk through some of those wishes.
Yeah.
I also think with infant loss, from time to time, we get calls of people who have had miscarriages. And sometimes those are very quiet and private losses. But if someone is experienced or has experienced a miscarriage, that we can be helpful in that as well. Because that is a loss. I worked about a year ago. One of the physicians at one of the hospital systems here called me and said, Kristen, I'm working with a mom who has had 14 miscarriages.
Wow.
And they are on their third round of IVF, and they have never, ever done anything to memorialize or say a blessing or a prayer for all of their losses. And it's weighed on them. This physician said it's weighed on my heart that we've never, is there anything we can do? And I said, absolutely. And so we did a beautiful service. The mom and dad invited about 17 people. She had ultrasound. They had ultrasound pictures from a number of their pregnancies. They had a lot of keepsakes, and we did one of the most private, beautiful services on a cold, rainy fall Saturday last year. Mm-hmm. But I think there was a lot of healing. But that's a lot of loss where she didn't, and the spouse didn't feel like they had an option to seek help.
Kristen Peterson, Tom Shelsky with Heritage Funeral Home. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. You can find today's episode wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find it on our website, sdpb.org/news. Special thanks to our guests today willing to come on public radio and talk about issues that often nobody wants to talk about. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngerman and Ellen Kester. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thank you for listening.